We now can start the Carolyn Gorton portion of the show. Portion of the program, as I say. Let's see. I got everybody muted. And I got to go grab the book. Do I have the book here? I have to go in the other room.
Just uh-oh.
You can start talking about it.
Yeah, but then you'll yell at me because you don't know where I am. But I think, well, what we ended with last week was me just quickly mentioning that Ridley Scott was highlighted in the book, and I think it was just a mention. So I'll say what he was involved in. What is likely the largest crowdsourcing project to date was sponsored by YouTube and National Geographic. It is director Kevin MacDonald's Life in a Day, a documentary produced by Ridley Scott that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2011. Oscar-winning MacDonald, best known for Last King of Scotland, collected 80,000 entries from around the world, all shot on the same day. The day was June 24, 2010. Along with editor Joe Walker of Steve McQueen's Hunger fame, guy Kevin MacDonald and Joe Walker distilled them down into a feature film that runs for just under 95 minutes. And Quirton further comments that using YouTube's upload function, MacDonald's Life in a Day team amassed 4,500 hours of footage from 192 countries. All of the chosen contributors are listed as co-directors. Multilingual film students were hired to sift through the footage, and 25 people were employed full-time for 2.5 months to view the material and sort it into categories, including countries of origin, themes, and to assess it on a 6-star system. So she was talking about crowdsourcing, basically, and that was an example of the largest crowdsourcing project to date, none of which would have been possible without the Internet and people all over the world being able to communicate by email and Skype and do their filming probably with their little Skype computers or their iPhones. So I thought that was cool. What did you think of it, Bob? And you're muted.
I had no thoughts about it. A lot of work.
Yeah.
What do they produce? What are the conclusions? What is their context for saying this?
Well, you know what it reminds me of? I guess it was at the millennial year 2000 where on New Year's Day or maybe New Year's Eve, I forget what, they filmed people all over the world and just showed everybody celebrating, not getting blown up by the computer world crashing. So it's just,
okay, so that,
it's an attempt, a tribal attempt.
They went around the world, time-wise, showing each area's New Year's Eve celebrations,
right.
Fireworks.
Right.
So, but her context, this chapter is called From Karaoke Culture to Vernacular Video. So vernacular video is what these people were making. They were making little videos and sending it someplace. And then they gathered it, and then they, broadcast it?
They made a 95-minute feature film of it.
Oh.
I haven't seen the film, but I guess it's out there called Life in a Day.
So they're showing all the producer mania of people with their digital media, Web 2.0, that they can spend their time with.
They can be famous.
Well, not famous. They just do it.
No, well, they did it, but they're all co-producers, co-directors. So that would make somebody in a country where they might not have even seen a feature-length film feel pretty powerful.
That they got shown in the final documentary.
Right.
So that's the hugely participatory nature of Web 2.0, which basic archetypal pattern, McLuhan said, in the electric age, participation mystique and the audience getting in the act is the main dynamic, starting with the vortices, 1914, and then the poetry, the writings of James Joyce, especially Finnegan's Wake, including the audience. So James Joyce is the mimer, the projector of the increasing involvement of everybody and everybody. That's the "here comes everybody" theme that he has as a nodal point in Finney's Wake. So when people talk about, wow, I can participate, I can make be part of this documentary that Ridley Scott's doing, and I like Ridley Scott, they say, oh, he does The Good Wife, I like that TV show. I live in Tanzania, so I don't see it for 5 years later, but I eventually saw it. I've seen season one.
Tanzania? Bob, that's not even a country.
Yeah, he's someplace. And then Bob's already watching season six on PrimeWire 10 seconds after the broadcast. But Tanzanians, they don't get it for 5 years. But they get there, and so they know who Ridley Scott is. They're glad to be part of his project. Mm-hmm. Well,
it becomes competitive participatory, because then you have the next guy, Roth's white
before you go into that? Okay, so Marshall, they say, well, in Marshall's day, mass media was passive. You were broadcast at. You sit and received information from a few channels. What Marshall tried to tell people, no, when you're watching television, you're making the image. So on the basic brain level, you are beginning to participate. You're not looking at a flat page with light bouncing off it. So you're looking and making shapes out of the snow of television. Remember that? They used to call it the snow, the test pattern.
Right.
So the participatory mandate starts coming in pop culture in the 50s and 60s. You know, the beatniks, the LSD world, the drug world, the happenings world, all across the range of culture and science, the participatory ideal, then some people call it democratic, started to come in. Now, I say that when you get to this level, 2.0, Web 2.0, this ain't no participation for you. This is the Android meme pretending it is participational among its parts.
Obviously, because he amassed 4,500 hours of footage. He got clips from 80,000 people, so no human can do that. So it's absolutely the robot doing it.
Right, and so when people say, well, this is what Tim Leary told me on May 15th, 16th, 1993, when we did that dialogue with him, me and Nelson, in his home, he was trying to say, well, Marshall was good, but he dealt with a one-way broadcasting world. We're here now in a two-way digital situation. And he was trying to say McCune failed to understand that. Well, Finnegan's Wake includes the analytical participatory brain mechanism that McCune was talking about, and includes the Android meme replay of participatory fakery. So you have to say participatory effects in the analog media and participatory effects in the digital media. They're two different kinds. So the Android meme in the digital phase makes media look very participatory, obviously participatory. Oh, look, I can email and they'll post my comment. I can do this. I can make YouTube. I can do all these things. Therefore, I'm participating.
But, therefore, I exist.
Yeah, therefore, I am sort of exist when I'm not working at my regular hardware job. I get home and I do my creativity. But that is the final seduction of the Android meme, as I've been warning people for 20 years. They're going to make it seem more and more about you, to the point, and this relates to that excerpt I played from Ion, you know, 10 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago. Eventually, you're going to be in a hologram, and you're going to run the show about what's the content of it. You're going to say, okay, today I'm going to be Francis Bacon, and they chip you with that, and then you rock around being Francis Bacon. I don't know how much you change the history of Francis Bacon. Is there a British Encyclopedia version that they give you? You know, standard one that all the scholars agree on, Francis Bacon. did not write Shakespeare's plays. He didn't edit them, no. But in my, but or would I have the choice? Oh, no, Frank Bacon. Frankie, he did do this. He did edit the Shakespeare. I got it from the Evergreens. I talked to Frank Bacon about it.
Back to Guertin, Bob.
No, no, but that's how far will it go when you make your own hologram? And so I was asking Ion if this whole Iondom thing that I'm an activator of, is this all within Bob's hologram? And that's why there's not a major event in the 20th century I haven't been part of. Well, did I program that? So that was my question. So you can go back and listen to Ion, what he said about that. It's not complete, but he started to say some things. So so the celebration, this is a problem in Carolyn Guertin's thesis. She's looking for democracy or participation or bottom-up something.
And she doesn't know it's the Android meme that's taken it over. It's all machinic. And I wanted to mention the next one.
Okay, but let me respond to that.
Fine.
The point
keep
is...
Keep up, Bob. Keep
yeah,
up.
No, about that point. It doesn't matter that it's machinic as far as your brain and perceptual self is. Look at these people all doing their iPhones all day long. They don't care that it's not a human being. So that's
no,
the question.
All I'm saying is if Guertin is trying to assuage us and say, oh, we're all participating together, it's all okay, it's
not
true.
Oh, she's
not
saying that. She's not saying that.
Are you sure?
She's saying that they are actually going to stop it with the canceling of the fair use thing through the Digital Prohibition Act.
Right.
Legislation that she's worried we can't even participate in the Android meme. So that's a good point. Why would the Android meme be excluding its delusion or its suggestion that you are part of it and they're not, and the Android meme's not in charge? Well, that's because the Android meme will never totally cancel you. They just tease you, bug you. They say, oh, okay, we're going to start canceling out all fair use stuff, which is what she documents, Carolyn Guertin documents, the creeping into fair use violation by the corporations. They're saying, you violated that, and you didn't. But they say you did, and they interrupt your YouTube making for a few months, and then you appeal it, and then you might get back. So the enemy is making you feel paranoid about it, and therefore... hyperactive, like this book that Carolyn Guertin wrote. She's an activist, or a hacktivist, or an artivist. So that is part of the seduction. What do we got? We got Janet Yellen raising the interest rate. Oh boy, it's big trouble coming, right?
A
little bit for a few people, because the punishment has to go through. That's another part of the Android meme that McLuhan picked up. The punishment factor or contrast that little man requires will continue to be manifested. So there will be huge devastating effects to some lucky people in the Yellen day, whereas others will not. So this is the tetradialectical yin-yang co-anesthesia-synesthesia dialectic that we are witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now your quote.
Yes, the next crowdsourcing, she talks about an artist named Roth, R-O-T-H, and he had a white glove tracking using crowdsourcing as a way of mapping data. On May 4, 2007, Roth asked web users to assist in isolating the white glove in all of the 10,000-plus frames of Michael Jackson's video, Billie Jean. Within 72 hours, 125,000 new versions of the data-tracked glove had been created. Now, how crazy is that? How crazy? What people with lots of time on their hands to do this?
Well, that's part of the Android meme reality, is that eventually you ain't going to have a job. At best, you have a role, but... Mark Stallman was interviewed recently, and he said, well, the main thing you have to know is that no one will ever have a job again. But there's no definite finish line. So there will be jobs provided here and there for somebody, and others won't get them. And those that can accept not wanting to have a job or having a job, they'll do other stuff. But so you got people, you got a lot of time to do this. So what did they do, Carol? They took the time to find the white glove?
Yeah, and they just spliced together, as I understand it. I spliced together all the images of the white glove and put it in a little video and sent it, hopping off to Roth.
Okay, so Carolyn Guertin says you would be projecting a practical object or purpose is realized. But these people are responding to the conversation that Roth started and participating. And that's the art form. You create a conversation and people start engaging. It doesn't matter how absurd the product looks, the product's not important. It's the action, it's the engaging of being part of something.
Mm-hmm. Participatory crap.
Now, a person like yourself, a practical, accomplished person, mm-hmm. looks for good results in what you do daily and expect results even more than most people. And this kind of behavior you wouldn't participate in. We can't see Dr. Deed going through a Billy G looking for the white gloves. You would never even have the time to do it.
Right.
So you're projecting your personality into this situation.
Yes. What else? Whose personality could I project? Or are you saying don't project any personality? Oh, you can't have an emotion. Oh, you can't have a feeling.
No, you put on another personality. You imagine, now, what would Dave Neufeld do this? The band that was supposed to come and see Dave Neufeld got caught in a snowstorm in Oshawa, and they won't make it to Dave. So Dave's got 24 hours to smoke up and diddle around. He could listen to Ion, he could call in here, or he might participate in this stuff, right? You wouldn't.
Right.
But you could pretend you were Dave Neufeld and act out a Dave Neufeld reality.
Absolutely. Okay, so then on page 132, she makes a couple of, I don't know, statements where she mentions things being lowbrow. So do you think she's talking about lowbrow versus highbrow in the whole Manipian tradition? Or
No.
Okay.
Lowbrow is the cheap. She agrees with Frank. Cheapness is better. Her temperament, so she's lived in a low-budget lifestyle for years in the fringe cabaret art world and not the super-glossy gallery world of Mary Boone and those people in New York City. She's in the almost the amateur world, the people of CKLN. That I knew, that are happy to have 20 people to be an audience in some club. That's lowbrow. That's what she means. That's lowbrow art. It, in the art, capital A art world. But lowbrow can also be just using cartoon imagery or porn or something that is not sanctioned by President Obama or Michelle Obama
or their daughters.
Or their daughters. You know, they're not known, they're not allowed to be known to be playing around with Larry Flint and Hustler magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That's because people require, the Andrew Amin pretends that there are people who require a sophisticated or civilized or decent protection of morals and lack of invasive and violence. So lowbrow can be that which ignores those decent standards.
Right.
There's different kinds. Now, a Manipian satirist would mix highbrow and lowbrow.
Ah, there you go.
So if she finds someone mixing both, and you might look for that, there must be someone in here who's mixing highbrow and lowbrow, because some of the artworks get into the major bicentennials or Vienna centennials, the biennials and that, you know, which are pretty high-end performances. Mm-hmm. If you get your art in there.
Yeah, I think she talks about some artists who take a classic film and then mash it up with a cartoon film. So perhaps that's a bit high-low.
No. Anybody can do that. It's where you put the film. Now, if you send it into the Kennedy Center to ask them to consider it as a major art form while they're celebrating Bob Dylan, that would be a Manipian act. You'd be satirizing an operation. But to mix thing, and she calls it a remix culture, which is like the Android meme remixes whatever was mixed during the human analog media phase. So the Android meme replays it, remixes it. That was the old characteristics of Manipian satire and doesn't apply now. That's not Manipian anymore. You have to be a different setup to be Manipian, and I suggest it's what this show is the actual retrieval of the anti-environmental function of Manipian satire. Because everybody started being Manipian in analog TV in those crazy day shows where people come on with their crazy ideas and crazy lifestyles and start fighting, beating each other up. What was it, Morley somebody? Whatever that guy was in the early 90s, had a TV show like that.
Right.
That's the population becoming Manipian, when it's no longer necessary to be Menippean. So the public, though, has no resort than to be Menippean in a post-literate, post-tragic, post-comic world. That's the world of everything's disappeared, as McLuhan's have said, before Greek literacy, it was an ironic, satirical form of communication. So everybody was a Menippean before Homer.
Cool.
So you're just wondering about the lowbrow world.
Yeah, I wonder how close she's getting to Menippean.
No, I think I've clarified the issue.
Oh, yeah. All right. Then going in a linear fashion, the next thing I have, I think we did talk about it last week. It was a spam bot art. Is really Finnegan's Wake, so we don't have to go over that again.
Wait, you said art. Spam bot art?
Yeah, people who take spam bots and make them into an art form. This artist, she got a spam bot to create a bunch of words and then made those words into a story. So the words are nonsense syllables.
All right, so Finnegan's Wake anticipates that ability, and what would that be? That could be a Menippean satire for high schoolers or something. It's very rudimentary. It's not sophisticated like the White House. I mean, this whole election around Donald Trump is one big Menippean Veronian operation, right? This whole campaign this year, all the parties involved are doing a major sophisticated Menippean satire on themselves and the voters.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's the only way you can get them involved.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. They're finally participating because they think it's such a big joke.
Right. Okay, and they're partly Menippean, the audience, and they say, okay, I'm going to be outrageous, and I'm going to support Trump. You know, so there's naive Menippeanism going on there.
So then she... excuse me. Then she says the word highbrow in this paragraph, page 136. She says the democratic urge is now starting to break down some of the most conservative walls up in the art world. In the past couple of years, highbrow institutions have started to jump on the remix bandwagon of this creative surge of energy. The result is festivals that are recognizing and commodifying art. And commodifying as art the best digital works. So highbrow institutions are getting into the game because they need to own it. They need to control it.
Right. So that's what I was saying. If you, now that the establishment is becoming as a patina, an image of Menippean acknowledgement, how do you satirize that, or how do you provide an anti-environment to that? So I wonder what she's going to say.
Well, she just gives examples. She's got amazing examples of everything, and basically she's just reporting, and she does comment as well. So she says about the YouTube, there was a YouTube biennial held in 2011 sponsored by YouTube and the Guggenheim, for Pete's sake. And it was done in four centers around the world. And the chief curator announced that we are, in a sense, inviting people to raise the standards of YouTube. Not satisfied with the lowly YouTube aesthetic, the Guggenheim sought immediately to make it more respectable. Directly contradictory to YouTube's founding principles, this drive toward commodification, even of the lowbrow, is inevitable in consumer culture.
Right, so there it is. They are the institution of Gutenberg elitism. Mm-hmm. In the creative process is maintaining the Gutenberg meme, and that's all they can do. All institutions can only be what they apparently were appreciated for, and they're going to make a value out of, okay, you YouTube, you anarchists out there, you... What's that guy? Kiggy.
You get in line.
You Kiggy people
get
out there.
Get in line.
Yeah, you should aspire to a recognition from Senator Clinton or something, you know, some acknowledgement at the Kennedy Center. And, of course, many people see through that or are not interested in that, and then they just get even more combative against the Guggenheim.
Yeah, because as she says, because they disdained the YouTube aesthetic, most of the big fish they caught were professional artists of the caliber that the Guggenheim might have considered for their regular collection anyway.
Right.
So they just, they catch the people. They pretend that they're doing this big outreach to the masses, and then they just focus on the people they want.
Right. So they call it a democratic urge. So is democracy allowing people more and more to express themselves as inventors, as gardeners, as school attenders, all the different things that people think fascism is stopping, and a large part of it would be human expression? That's one form of democracy. Is that the most important ideal of democracy, or is democracy limited to people having access to the bureaucrats that they send to Washington or to their municipal governments, and somehow more and more people have a say in the local government? So the democratic urge as a participatory aesthetic started with jazz and maybe the whatever that first dance was, the cakewalk or something. I can't remember what the jazz, what were they called, the floozies, the fanniers or something.
Flappers,
yeah. That whole world of they show it a bit in Downton Abbey when the aristocratic daughters are tempted to go to some clubs where the dancing is not as rigid and formal. So that's the aristocrats starting to adopt the Cockney rhythms or the working classes rhythms, and they start to merge. And that's the effect of electricity. That's McLuhan's point, is that the boundaries between the classes start to fall away in all the institutions, and that includes games and leisure activities. Or is democracy you not participating in a mass game, but having the ability to project as a god your own digital production, your own multimedia production? Is that the pinnacle of democratic something. Democratic.
Mumble.
Bill, change the... Bill's picking up my phone. Come on, Bill. Stop zapping my phone, Bill. Bill phone. Yeah, the people are wonderful. Very wonderful people.
So, do you want me to go on before you self-combust?
Yeah, I resort to democratic appreciation, the emotional multitude. We love you all. Let's all try to get along. But do you have the desire to go out and make a video that's astounding and assert your incredible digital dexterity?
No.
Would you get an identity out of that? Well, Carolyn Guertin represents those people who do want to have that. The old artistic impulse they maybe drew when they were a kid. They're in the early grade school, and the teacher point out their ability to get to do good drawings, and they thought, oh, that's my identity. And then that probably happened to Sheila Kern. You know, she's probably seen as a great drawer when she was 4 years old, and then she stuck with it as her form of identity. You know, is that where creativity comes from? Because the teacher told you you were creative, and someone else is a good athlete, so they become a jock. What will happen when the kids don't have that kind of social role-playing, no, social model-making?
Well, I can't imagine what it's like in schools these days for so-called guidance counselors or career counselors to guide kids. You know, back in my day, as I've said it many times, with my, 99-plus average and vice president of the student council and running the whole school, I was told I could be an executive secretary or a nurse. So I was never modeled to do anything.
No, that was your model. It was restricted.
Well, I refused the model then.
Yeah, well, that's because I was there encouraging that. You may not have done it without my encouragement.
Oh, I doubt that very much.
Oh, you think that you had the innate ability to resist?
Grumble. okay, back to Guertin.
Yeah,
the next little bit I have, it's a mashup that...
Okay, Carolyn, okay, back to that sentence.
What? You're always interrupting.
Yeah, the democratic urge is now starting to break down some of the most conservative walls in the art world. But then you've pointed out that, no, Guggenheim did not maintain a real democratic aesthetic. They said, you lowbrow mob people, flash mobs, you got to upgrade your aesthetic
mm-hmm.
standards.
Mm-hmm.
So there's... And
they rose the bar. They raised the bar.
Right. So I think Guertin is aware of that, and she discusses these questions about what's her identity as a critic or an artist in relation to these conflicting co-anesthetic and synesthetic tendencies in the Android meme. Okay, I just wanted to say that.
This is a mashup. This is jumping to another topic. Somebody did a mashup where a modern warfare soundtrack was combined with game footage. So they used an audio from a U.S. military strike, which ended up being a high-profile attack in which two Reuters correspondents and a group of unarmed civilians were killed. And a camera tripod was erroneously assumed to be an automatic weapon. Had you heard of that attack?
Yes. I actually saw it somewhere. What is the name, the artist, so I can look this up?
Call of Duty, it's page 137. Bricker.
Oh, yeah. Bricker's Post-Newtonianism?
Yes.
Which I discuss in part two is a near-perfect mashup. Okay. Yes, I've seen that footage. There's several like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's, it's certainly not highbrow and lowbrow, but it's realism with game playing, putting game footage and associating it with warfare footage with people that, you know, people knew who was killed. They were Reuters correspondents. Okay, so that was...
So what the point here is, by pointing out
it's not all just comedy, parody, and satire. You know, a lot of the artists are trying to make a point. They're trying to expose various aspects of either the commodification of the world or the politics or...
Or no, maybe... Isn't this that patriotic warfare is really just like a video game? Aren't they trying to show that the values of being a soldier, defending your country, or stopping terrorism gets reduced to a video game reality?
That's a good point. Maybe she's making that point where they can just point a stealth bomber at this tripod and take it out. As if it were a video game.
So she blends the idealized, innocent animation of the hookah-smoking caterpillar from Disney's Alice in Wonderland with 3-6 Mafia's rah-rah.
No, that's the next mashup.
Oh, okay. So what is this? This is the mashup section? You're looking at mashups?
I think
or
so.
Remixes?
Mashup, I forget.
Okay, what's the next one?
It's what you're talking about. Lindsay Scroggins did a mashup where she put the hookah-smoking caterpillar from Alice in Wonderland with 3-6 Mafia's raw, rough, shocking gangsta rap music. And in perhaps the most uncomfortable 1 minute and 44 seconds you have ever heard.
Yeah, that's funny that she finds it very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's what Guertin says. In her director's video, she says that it took her between 200 and 300 hours to make the cuts and synchronize the sound. As an assessment of hip-hop-style drug and sex-laden themes and how uneasily they fall upon childish ears, as the world is so often revealed to the young, the work is disturbing in the extreme. I'm not getting what this disturbance is. Are you?
Well, we haven't seen the film. I mentioned there's a lot of foul language and guns and, you know, gangsta stuff. And it's like, I don't know if it's this one, but several times she's had things where the gangsta rap people are now the new mafia.
Mm.
So this was interesting having this. I don't know what 3-6 Mafia is. That must be
a band.
Hip-hop. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's saying that the mafia is gangsta?
I'm saying it. It's interesting how the new mafia is the gangsters, the gangstar.
And where do you have evidence of that?
In my head.
That sounds racist.
Well, they're just, they want to take over.
Well, they're domestic terrorists.
Right. I went back to the beginning of the chapter. It's part two, authorship, from karaoke culture to vernacular video. So it's just about videos, it seems. It's not necessarily mashups, but she's using mashups as examples.
Well, vernacular, the printing press allowed people to see their own language, native language or national language, wasn't even national, but non-Latin, non-Greek, in print. And that was called the vernacular. And that was the print world. So now you have people, lowbrow producers, making video with all kinds of chaos or anarchy or aesthetic, pushing the envelope, and that's like a new kind of vernacular. Mm. It's vernacular video. I think that's the meaning of that phrase. Vernacular right. video rather than vernacular books.
Yeah, they have to have a whole new language. Then, I don't know if you want to go into this. It's the digital remixing. She talks about 141, and she has seven distinct kinds of remixes. I don't know if we want to bother doing that.
Yeah, do that.
Right.
We've only been going for a short while.
Well, nobody's listening on the chat line. They're totally ignoring us.
How do you know?
Because I've been over there.
Let's see. No, they're talking about 3-6 Mafia.
Well, now that we mention some hip-hop, they don't care about the topic.
Well, some people think D-O, do, is Ion. Because do posts Hendiety Scrabble score 17, and Yuri goes, he's here! And then Yuri comments on his own exclamation, screams like a little schoolgirl. And then Leon, who might know about 3-6 Mafia and Alice in Wonderland, he finds that funny, the combination of 3-6 Mafia and Alice in Wonderland. He's falling for the satire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's about it, though. Here's Dave saying, by the way, I heard the Pet Shop Boys were successfully sued by Cat Stevens for It's a Sin being too similar to Wild World. I haven't looked at it up to verify it. I like him speculating. So, yeah, there's an example of copyright infringement for one mm-hmm. generation, the baby boomer Cat Stevens, going after Generation X, the Pet Shop Boys. Or maybe even less. A Remax, Priest, the air swells when I hear this song. There's some other... So Yuri and them are yucking it up there. They're mashing away. See, you have the audience typing. There's the example of the participation of this kind of digital media.
Yeah, they're doing exactly these seven steps. They're sampling us. Then they're mashing up a bit of us and a bit of them. They're remaking, adapting, intertexting. They're capturing. They're surveilling. They're archiving, and they're hacking.
Right. And these are the primary forms.
Mm-hmm.
But these methods are not mutually exclusive. A single work can mix and match two or more different techniques. It is on account of this fluid, promiscuous nature that Paul D. Miller, also known as DJ Spooky. Now, he's the guy who's been accepted by High Art. He was put on the board of C-Theory, Coker's World, allowed to mingle with the academics.
Hmm.
And Paul Miller calls this cybernetic jazz, this remixing, rhythmic cinema, and sonic sculptures in his book Rhythm Science. Well, he wrote a book that helped him get noticed by the academia, who are the real gatekeepers of culture, the professors. So you got here, they're going to have a whole section on sampling, and it's called A Tactical Aesthetic. There are seven distinct kinds of remixes or what I would call A Tactical Aesthetic approaches. And another word is aberrant decoding. So she's coming up with big word talk
mm-hmm.
to put order to the chaos of producer mania.
Yeah.
So... there's lots. Let me just scan through here. I have under mashups.
Yeah.
there's this quote from Guy Debord. Okay, he's a...
I love that quote.
You know what I'm going to do?
Yep.
Guy Debord wrote this probably in the 60s or 50s, so he's the French popular version of McLuhan, the lowbrow people think. McLuhan is too highbrow for many people. So Guy Debord says, any elements, no matter where they are taken from, can serve in making new combinations. The discoveries of modern poetry regarding the analogical structure of images demonstrate that when two objects are brought together, no matter how far apart their original context may be, a relationship is always formed. Now, I have beside that McLuhan. That's his line from The Medium is the Massage. When information is brushed against information, the results can be startling and effective. So that is what McLuhan called bashing cliches to make together to make new archetypes. So I'm pointing out that what Guy Debord is making a big deal of McLuhan was already discussing in the 50s. Now, this is Debord in 1956, so it's pretty early, same time as McLuhan, but usually they're talking about content, the clashing of symbols and memes from content, whereas McLuhan was talking about the form of TV against the form of radio, against the form of book, against the form of Aboriginal ESP.
This is the quote I thought you were going to give. Guy Debord says in his prescription for methods of detournement, one is not limited to correcting a work or to integrating diverse fragments of out-of-date works into a new one. One can also alter the meaning of those fragments in any appropriate way, leaving the imbeciles to their slavish preservation of citations.
Right, citations and quotes.
Mm-hmm.
So he then continues that, and he says, restricting oneself to a personal arrangement of words is mere convention. The mutual interference of two worlds of feeling, or the bringing together of two independent expressions, supersedes the original elements and produces a synthetic organization of greater efficacy. Anything can be used. Now, McLuhan used to say when he wrote his books, he'd use anything. So Debord is talking about this, but it's always in an activist context, or a communist context, or an anarchist context. They politicize what they're doing. Debord thinks he's running some kind of revolution or starting one.
Yes.
Whereas McLuhan works on a grander, huger level that in the long run is better for the citizen to know about than to get carried away by Allen Ginsberg or Paul Krasner or Frank Zappa or some revolutionary that comes in, stirs you up and makes you quit your job, and then you end up homeless and a junkie. Like reading Patti Smith's book, they show up in New York City in 1968, and they end up down in East Village, and they're desperate and have no money, so they go to the cheapest hotel there, and it's nothing but junkie garbage.
Yeah.
And that's 1968. You did not see the junkie world was not told to the kids in high school in 67, 68. They didn't know that existed. They know it once Junkie Chic came in, and whenever that was, the late 80s, early 90s. But, you know, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe were shocked at this chaotic ghetto world of white kids just being junkies, or people all ages, white people just devastating their lives. Former ballet people, former well-off artists, they just got lost in junkie land, and that was not part of the news world in the 68. It is part of, everybody knows about junkies by now, and they hope their own child is not a junkie, right? And many fail to stop their kids from becoming junkies temporarily. So,
And then the whole Keith Richards biography that highlighted it for me.
Yeah, now Keith Richards popularized it
in
the early 70s, middle 70s. He popularized the musician as junkie. And he said he was constantly subject to people predicting he would die soon. And he's so proud of himself never having died.
For not dying. But Patty, I don't know when she started doing drugs, but she just looked like a junkie, she said. But she, at an early point, she was not doing drugs.
No. Mapplethorpe was starting to, I think, and she found it quite disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you read the whole book. Did she doesn't get into drugs in her story?
No. No, she started smoking, but she would just smoke alone to do her art.
Mm.
Smoking dope, but as far as I can tell, she really never got into it.
Okay, so back to this. DeBoard is celebrating a certain civil rebellion. And McLuhan, being a highbrow artist, because he's including the attitudes of intelligence agencies, he is operating on a wider, broader scale. And so the activists don't like that. They don't like McLuhan's detachment. Walter Boer complained about it. Abby Hoffman complained about it.
Yeah, they just want people to get involved, pick up a placard and start protesting. But, you know, I know firsthand that that doesn't work. What I'm doing is working far better than when I was involved with the so-called health freedom movement.
Right. So now the artist has got the aura, the romantic aura of being some kind of outsider. And Carolyn Guertin is keeping the outsider mystique going, but knows it has to be updated.
Mm.
She says creativity and the creative product. Well, the creative product is obsolete, is what she says. She says activism is obsolete, but she's trying to find something that maintains the anti-bourgeois.
Well, she may say activism is obsolete, but she's reporting on the activism and giving it cachet.
Well, it seems she supports activism in the image-making world that is reflexive, that is meta-meta, that comments on the irony of the fact they're trying to make something unique and yet it's hopeless, and they probably will be shut down anyways by YouTube's digital copyright prohibition or something.
Right.
So there's I would call that quadrophenia. That is people aware of different modalities coming at them, different environments, and different memes, different audiences, and everybody is, you've got many audiences already implied in your life with your different bodies. That's the what? That's the problem of creativity. I don't know where I was going with that. You got this multi-body.
There's so many levels, meta.
Oh, yeah.
And so, how do you keep up?
So it's normal awareness to have multiple levels. As a matter of fact, McLuhan used to say that in the 50s, students thought in levels.
Mm-hmm.
And these levels were them trying to keep their literate framework and fit the different contradictory media experiences into the framework. And then when the baby boomers got into drugs, the framework collapsed. They didn't have a literate framework.
Mm-hmm.
And then neoconservatism came along to retrieve the literate framework so that you could think in levels and keep it tidy, whereas the non-neoconservative artist tends to reestablish mental chaos or categorical chaos, tries to encourage people to note that their retrieved framework isn't working. Then other people like McLuhan say, well, the population's not going to survive this, so we just better turn TV off in general, turn off the environment, the new environment, so people can keep their literate framework or understand why it's being eroded.
Well, what's interesting for me is the next book I'm reading is, what's it called, Freewheeling?
Yeah, Susie Rotolo.
Yeah, she was Dylan's first girlfriend, apparently. And her upbringing was...
First New York girlfriend. He had a girlfriend in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
This is the one that's on the cover of Freewheeling Bob Dylan, Susie Rotolo.
So she presents her horrific childhood as a red diaper baby. Her parents were communists, so she talks about growing up as an outcast and growing up through the, what's the guy who exposed all the communists?
The McCarthy era.
Growing up in the McCarthy era and finding out that her friends' fathers were in jail and just the horror of waiting for the bomb to fall. So she presents a whole other world. I'm only in her sort of high school days right now. Her father died when she was in high school, and that ruined her life. So anyway, that was a whole other picture being painted of the communist children growing up.
Yeah, they were the activists of the 50s.
They were.
And now LaRouche said that he hung out with the socialist parties in the 50s because they were the most intellectually active. They were critical. Mm-hmm. And so Susie Rotolo grows up in the heart of it in Manhattan.
They were reading books and going to plays, performing in plays, marching. They were doing all that stuff while the young people in the village were just sitting around doing dope and, you know, drawing pictures. Mapplethorpe was trying to get exposure for his art.
Well, that's a few years later. Susie Rotolo's the late 50s. Mapplethorpe is 10 years later. So so Susie Rotolo's part of the world that Bob Dylan stumbled into and was swallowed up in for a while. And
yeah, and it goes into the coffee houses and
right. That was the art movement. You know why they coffee houses became artistically self-conscious? They saw the if they even knew about rock and roll, they saw the cleaning up of rock and roll, the arrest of Alan Freed and the payola scandal, and it wasn't even illegal to do payola back then. But they saw the mainstreaming of rock and roll, so that it became a bunch of little teenage guys like Fabian and Bobby Vinton and Bobby V. So the teenagers and their parents said, whatever energies that were rebellious and interesting in Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry have been squelched. And so we have to create an anti-environment to the Bobby V, Bobby Vinton thing. And so they grabbed the folk music because you had a bunch of lefties like Alan Lomax and this other guy, I can't remember.
Pete Seeger.
No, they were performers. Yes, you see, Pete Seeger was in the Weavers. And they were blacklisted in the early 50s.
Right, as communists.
Right. So communist. So folk. So folk music was nowhere through most of the 50s until the record companies ruined the image of rock and roll by putting Elvis in the army. So then the college kids, they need an identity, or some of them need an identity of rebellion. So they said, okay, we're going for non-commercial music. The folk culture, the lowest, the coal miner music.
Mm-hmm.
So they put on and started to celebrate folk music based around Harry Smith's album. He put together an anthology that Bob Dylan and all these kids in their late teens listened to be put on. Now, Bob Dylan was a rock and roller in high school. He played in the school gym and had a band and shocked his English teacher with what he could do, this dirty, lowbrow music. And then two years later, he's doing folk music and not part of the Chuck Berry world.
Yeah.
Because it was an artistic, cool stance it was the cabaret culture that Karen Gwerton celebrates.
And is this, you're getting this from Weinstein's book?
No, I knew that. I knew this for through the years.
Whereas the Chuck Berry and all that genre, that was picked up by Keith Richards in London.
Oh, they were British. See, that's what's funny or interesting is that the American kids, it's almost like the British kids didn't know about the Bobby Vinton thing.
Uh-huh.
They were getting the rock and roll a couple years later. So they were going through Chuck Berry and Elvis and all that stuff in 59, 60, 61, 62, and then into blues, whereas the American kids were kicked out of that access and put on the people's music, folk music.
Wow.
And so Pete Seeger came back as the leader of it because he'd been a Weaver suppressed in 52 by McCarthy. So that's why Pete Seeger comes back with this gravitas and seniority of outsiderness. And meanwhile, the satellite comes in and starts becoming a cause of the global theater in 62, 63. And Dylan, responding to the present as a sensitive artist, he can't stand being a folk singer anymore. He's sick of it.
There you go.
The reasons for the folk thing died because the Beatles came over and the Stones came over. They brought back the wild music, the rock and roll. Okay, we don't have radio is different now. It's interesting, says the college-aged person, and we don't need to be boring, dull, monochromatic folk singers. Let's go electric. And that's what Dylan did.
Wow.
And
yeah, because the venues to perform in, they just had folk singers.
It was almost a kind of cultural warfare.
Yeah.
The British got ahead of Dylan, these guys, in 63, 64, 65 with their British invasion. And then Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa, Dylan said, we got to get back in this game and support the be a patriot, American patriot, and bring back. So that's why Dylan calls his album in 65, Highway 61 Revisited.
Mm.
That is, he's retrieving the blues and underground music of the early 50s, which became partly the Chuck Berry world, the popularization of it. He retrieves that mystique. It's almost like, okay, we know what you're doing, Mick and Keith. You're remarketing our Highway 61 roots back to us. So Jagger never said that. Dylan said it. He says, technically, as an intellectual thing, it's Highway 61 Revisited, because you go down Highway 61, that's where a lot of these guys going back to Robert Johnson were born or had dramatic events on Highway 61 from New Orleans up to Winnipeg. So Dylan's very scholarly there with his title,
mm-hmm.
you know, or self-conscious. He had been in a bluesy mood 7 years before. So, and Dylan Casey comments on this. He said in his Rolling Stone interview in 1969, he says, I wasn't aware as I should have been. And he sometimes acts guilty or repentant about the way he was. Maybe I exploited the folk scene for a while, you know.
Really?
But
because I've read one of the books about Dylan recently, and I did not come away with the impression that he'd been a rock and roller, he switched to folk, and then he came back to rock and roll. And I don't think a lot of people know that. They just think he was a folky defected.
Yeah, he didn't go back to rock and roll. He invented folk rock. The Byrds popularized his tambourine song, but he definitely moved into a new kind of music with Like a Rolling Stone and Highway 61 Revisited. That book you read is Dylanologist,
mm-hmm.
about the Dylanologist. That might not go into that aspect because it's just about the fans.
Right.
But so you're saying you didn't know that he'd been a rock and roller.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's see, what else to say? So we're saying that's when, in the 60s, when acoustic space was the art form. Carolyn Guertin is dealing with tactility as an art form, the interactive sculpting of imagery on the proprioceptive level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the tactile, but she's projecting countercultural ideals on the tactile revolution of digital media, of digital co-creation. So she's projecting countercultural Bob Dylan, Rolling Stone ideals that are against the commodification of regular pop music. Carolyn Guertin is all for she tends to be in favor of the art that satirizes or puts down the commodification that the Guggenheim was going to bring in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they said, we're going to upgrade your video submissions and make a competition out of it. Now, you were going to say something about a competition? Somebody competed with somebody?
Let me check my list.
Now, Dave would know. Let's see what Dave says here. They got some statements here. Sean from London says, producer mania shows people's urge to create outside of themselves, to see proof or validation. Yes, the desire to translate oneself into another form is Tom Waits' ideal. If you don't know the West Coast till you go to the East Coast. So people can use different media to translate their usually literate values. They grow up in the West with literate book values, but they aren't attracted to the book medium. So Yuri says, wallet science? Yuri says, forest research too? Please, using prayer hands. And then he sighs. Then Dave says, amazing angle, Bob, on UK versus US and the British bypassing the lightweight rock stage in the US. Oh, Dave liked that. And McLuhan also said the British had more acoustic heritage than Americans, or at least in the Americans in the North. Yeah, that's really important. Mm. Is First of all, when Kennedy was assassinated, so late 63, just before the Beatles came on, McLuhan is being interviewed. He's starting to get noticed, and he's saying the South is taking over in music. So he saw Elvis and Chuck Berry as the South coming into American culture, which he said in the 50s would come in because the Southern oral culture resonated with the TV effect. So then you get this deeper tactile mood mud caused by the global theater and the new Sputnik satellite environment. And so Dave is right. The British, they had deeper oral society than the kinetic visual American. McLuhan said, never before had British pop culture allowed singing on the Cockney level, on the poorest level, to be part of the vaudeville accepted middle class entertainment theaters.
And it was really fun reading Keith Richards' book to hear how they were attacked. You know, they go into clubs and sing their stuff and with their long hair, and they'd be called girls, and they get into fights every night because they were changing the whole aesthetic.
Now look at this. Here's a subtle thing. The British students, even though they're more naturally oral, they're oral visual, whereas Americans are visual kinetic and oral a little bit. So the oral visual kids are a bit delayed. They're not getting the global theater technologies that the States are getting in the early 60s. The satellite's going around the whole planet, but you can see that the British kids were a little more conservative, whereas as soon as Jagger and them go with the long hair go to the America, they are accepted because they're more tactile, low definition, and more hairy and more multisensory in their image than that the American kids are ready for because they've been mutated by the satellite environment.
You've already said a couple of weeks ago that the Beatles were primed to be accepted in America because people were looking for relief from the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, that's taking a particular emotion from one event, a major event, but that you can't create a musical revolution based on a feeling. That would die out.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, the Beatles would kill the remorse, and then what are they going to do next? So there has to be other media dynamics going on that the Beatles are riding more than just being a relief from the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
But people like Lester Bangs, they would point this out. It was a particular little interesting point, but not the, that's where McLuhan is talking about larger dynamics, and whoever I was saying, Carolyn Gwerton and the artists are keeping it smaller. McLuhan was ready to ride all the changes from he commented on the folk, on the Pete Seeger world, the Oscar Brand world, then he commented on the Beatles, and then on the Stones, and then on the psychedelic, and then the country rock, and then all the movements. They all fit into McLuhan's plan because he was looking at effects over 20-year spans.
He wasn't around for rap, though, was he?
No. Rap came in. Rap knocked him out. He got sick every time there was a new technological revolution, and he recovered, but he didn't recover in 79, and that's about when hip-hop started to happen in 79 with Flash Jack or somebody. I forget the guy's name. But so Dave is saying, now Dave loves this kind of talk. Dave likes the bigger picture that McLuhan gives, and so his ideas are interesting. So he's saying, you watch the shifting. So the Stones make it big, and they would get beat up if they went down south by the good old boys.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't see the Stones being beat up in a club in L.A. You got this whole thing going on with the Trip and the Whiskey Go-Go, and the kids are being beat up by the police and the shop owners. But Dylan goes and lives in L.A. in that time, hangs out there. So there's a big revolution in 65 in L.A. that Zappa's part of, Insensibility, and that is responding to the beginning of Lemuria sensibilities as you move out of the hardware Atlantis sensibilities I have in my chart. Lemurian is just pure software delusion or fantasy virtual reality. So Dave says, talking about Susie Rotolo, this is Gene. I guess she's quoting her. The 60s were an era that spoke a language of inquiry and curiosity and rebelliousness against the stifling and repressive political and social culture of the decade that preceded it. The new generation causing all the fuss was not driven by the market. We had something to say, not something to sell. Because the global theater made everybody be 4 years old, everybody was equally capable of having an opinion. This was redone in Web 1.0 with the Android meme making, hey, here's your computer, you can express your opinion. But it's on the chemical body level, and that's where what Rotolo is saying is very limited. That's not what's happening. The kids are not expressing them. They're having an identity crisis due to the satellite. The kids are having as much identity crisis as their parents are. So Susie Rotolo doesn't see it as an identity crisis. She just sees them against something that happened in the past, in the 50s. So
They never see the bigger picture like you do.
Right. And Yuri, I think he falls for Gene's quote, and he says, that is perfect. No, it isn't, Yuri. Then Dave says, mind you, the lightweight British stuff was pretty lightweight, too. It really was the British interpretation empire level epitomized by the Beatles and the Stones and Zeppelin. Yeah, like when Zeppelin comes in the late 60s, we're now into a deeper caveman reality, almost 10 years of satellite implosion, and the hard rock of Led Zeppelin. It creates this new music, heavy metal and all that, which they didn't even call it that for many years. They didn't even know that's what it was. Mm-hmm. But I remember when we were driving around in Seattle in the fall of 69 with Dave Wurster, and we would drive out to his place, and Paul Seibel would have this Led Zeppelin thing on. I'd say, geez, that's fucking rough or something. I remember thinking, that's not better than Frank. That's bad Frank. Because Frank was the roughest. Uh-huh. In that period. Uh-huh. But he didn't present
it. But he was smooth rough.
Well, that's because his albums were edited for other purposes, and you didn't get the experience the way Frank was in a club. Go back and read the descriptions of what went on in the Garrick Theater. It was incredible what Frank was doing, and it was heavy metal before heavy metal, plus many other things. But Frank would present a polished, edited, abstract image idea, almost a movie, in his albums. So Led Zeppelin comes along, and they're very, whatever you call it, bone-conducting tactile.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who responded to that. I didn't like Led Zeppelin when I first heard them. They seemed to be too monotone. They didn't have the variety and shifts of change that Zappa had.
Mm-hmm.
But they, if you look back, that was more caveman-like.
Well, why is...
You know what I mean? That the Led Zeppelin 69-70 was caveman music, compared to what was being done by Vanilla Fudge or even Love, Arthur Lee. It was a bit nicer. Maybe Dave has something to say about that. So what's Dave saying here? So you
Led Zeppelin, an English rock band formed in London in 1968. With Jimmy Page, Robert Plant.
It's the same people. That's Giorgio Gomelsky's people. That's the Yardbirds, who were replaced the Rolling Stones at the Crawdaddy Club. So it's the same core musicians.
Yeah, changed their name from the New Yardbirds.
Right. There's several phases of the Yardbirds, New Yardbirds, and then Jimmy Page or one of them, Robert Plant, takes over, and then they become Led Zeppelin. I think they even had a different name in 68. But they're being guided by Gomelsky.
Led Zeppelin are widely considered one of the most successful, innovative, and influential rock groups in history.
Well, in the long run, caveman sensibility is what kids grow up into more than the 50s and 60s generations.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just thrown into... the bottom of the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
So then Dave says the 60s still had a thriving hardware world versus now. Yeah. No hardware world. Well, the kids aren't even into music today. They don't care about music. You know, we went to that New Year's Eve club and down here at the Andes Hotel. That was ridiculous, the music they played.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same inky disco beat. But anyways, I wasn't complaining. Europe was a great seat for that, says Yuri. Who's Afraid of 138? American Media Bank, thanks. Grandmaster Flash, yes, that was one of the first guys. The Breakthroughs never, that was 79. Yuri says, the Breakthroughs never faltered. Music families run this planet, my friend. And then Dave says, yes, the Web 1.0 is akin to the so-called summer of 67 in terms of idealism. Yes, information longs to be free. Web 2.0 kills that thing. Dave says, Zeppelin cast a spell on the planet. Well, they're responding to the depth of a satellite Sputnik World Squared.
Hmm.
You have to realize, Dave, go look at Apocalypse Now, Coppola's movie, which is about the late 60s, and the young American soldiers are in the jungle, and they don't know what the hell's going on. There's weird monster gangs with weird sounds. There's weird music. It's all caveman, very well expressed by Coppola. That movie is made in 76, 77, 78, 79. Coppola has a heart attack. But it's showing the jungle, the heart of darkness that was happening in American culture and in Vietnam in 69, 70. That's where the Led Zeppelin would appeal to a soldier experience. And the planet was becoming that. Zepp fused to brow, fused low brow with high brow, with low brow with ear brows. white zombie. Okay, Zepp knows best. Now, whatever south they came from is deeper than blood. Okay, that's a good point. I'm saying that the discarnate world of the television radio well of loneliness has been squared by the time Zeppelin comes along and their hard and rough tactile abrasive sounds meets that sensibility, at least for young people. What's happening at the time of Led Zeppelin in mainstream American bandstand level or even PBS, respectable TV? It's the depressing guys, James Taylor, Neil Young. They come in with this Carole King, this kind of light, depressing post-Kent State attitude.
Light rock.
Yeah, I don't know what they call that. Light, depressed rock. So that's what people...
Tired and emotional music.
So, yeah, James Taylor and them were the disco, and the Sex Pistols and the Ramones countered the disco effect, you know, in the late 70s. But
well, Taylor wasn't disco.
No, I'm saying James Taylor is the Led Zeppelin.
Oh, okay.
And
yes.
Disco is to
the Ramones
and me and Sex Pistols. So, but why was that happening? In the bland disco, it wasn't that bland in the late 70s, but it was bland compared to punk. But disco had an upbeat mood because people had gotten through the depressing early 70s. Vietnam had ended in 75, and so there was an upbeat Carter replay of the Kennedy era in the disco frenetic. That.
Well, disco was... what I vaguely recall when I was in medicine, so I was just happy there was nothing going on when I was in medicine so I wouldn't be distracted.
Right. You were a natural party girl, and you would have gone to the party if there had been one. But you did. You didn't work in the summer, and we went to the parties in New York City in 75, 76, 74, 75, 76, 77. And you got to be at the punk scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, thanks to me, we avoided the disco and found CBGBs.
Right.
So we were part of the lowbrow, cabaret, indecent, in-your-face.
And that's
amicus.
Where Patti Smith was.
Well, I met Patti in April 75.
Mm-hmm.
I went to, she was at CBGBs, and that was one of her first runs.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke to her, I asked her what... does she know about Finnegan's Wake? And she says yes. And so then, as I've told this before, she stuck that phrase in her second set.
Mm-hmm.
But she's now being replayed as some kind of icon today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because she won the National Book Award for Just Kids. And I'm reading Just Kids, and it ain't National Book Award quality.
Well, they have to prop her up because she survived. I mean, that they look at the 1,000 people through those years, and she survived, one of very few.
This is part of the theme last week, the negativity. They have to be negative. They have to survive negativity.
Right.
And they have to be semi-comatose or semi-depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So, like Stephen Hawking. So then Gene says, Dave says, oh, leave Carole King alone, Bob. That's sacred territory. Almost Patsy Cline level. Well, that's where where Dave and I, at part because Carole King was a good songwriter in Tin Pan Alley, but her music was not something. But Dave was young. He didn't know any better.
Mm.
And then Patsy Cline is real. Gene, she says, my brother's platoon in Vietnam was tripping much of the time on the front lines, but he wasn't. Always wondered where the soldiers got the LSD. I don't wonder anymore.
Hmm.
And then Dave says, where'd they get it, Gene? Probably the same guys that gave it to Walter Boert, don't you think, says Gene. Kyle, well, look at this. Kyle comes in. Crosby, Nash, Stills, and Young was anti-war music. No, anti-student music. They came in as a result of Kent State, the murdering of, not any war, it was the cops who killed the protesters. It was domestic.
Hmm.
It was not, the anti-war thing had been done by, the Fokies and, Jefferson Airplane? I don't know who did anti-war.
Jane Fonda.
No, that's later.
Mm-hmm.
And she did it in her movies. But it's interesting to think of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, such flakes, and, you know, the cherry vanilla people like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And, of course, Frank did great satires on them. They were protesting the murder of college kids. Now, a guy like Kyle, a rambunctious Christian fundamentalist, would be looking at things in black and white and would think it's peace versus war, Christians versus pagans. Right, Kyle? It's not your bag?
Young and Nash released Young Song, War Song, to support George McGovern's presidential campaign.
That's 1972. Crosby, Stills, and Nash are 69. Woodstock at 69.
Right. Okay, gotcha.
You had to go back to what they did then. You got to get back to the garden. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
They were just celebrating Laurel Canyon. Now, here's Kyle. Kyle, you realize you've got all this capital, you know, you don't have to type in capital letters. Kyle says, did you ever go to a Grand Funk Railroad concert tripping on LSD? They were the bomb, man. Now, we were not impressed with Grand Funk Railroad. What we were impressed with is that they hired Frank Zappa to produce their album in 1976. and Frank, ever the anthropologist, was interested in these guys because he knew the Grand Funk Railroad weren't hip. They weren't popular among the sophisticates. So he purposely went and hung out with them and came out and pronounced, you guys are nuts. These are the greatest kids around. So he promoted their unhipness.
And in April 1970... Young and Crosby were staying at a house in San Francisco when reports of the Kent State shootings arrived, inspiring Young to write the protest song Ohio, recorded and rush released weeks later, providing another hit.
Yeah, that would not be April. They got that wrong because Kent State is the first week of May, 1970. They say April 70 is Kent State?
Well, they had a few more events and then they went into Kent State.
So, you know, you have the problem Zappa has. He's saying that Woodstock is the signal that the big corporations are going to go into the all countercultural rock music. They're going to exploit it or turn it, commodify it. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Yet, in TV body terms, Woodstock is considered a great archetypal garden event canceled out by Altamont. You know, a few months later,
mm-hmm.
But the iconic meaning of Woodstock, one mind like Zappa's cannot counter the effect of that icon when you're dealing with a TV global environment, right?
I suppose so, Bob.
Like Frank would just come off as a stick in the mud.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he didn't go to Woodstock. He broke up the Mothers right after Woodstock, I think. He was probably on the road. So here comes Minnie Max, the Trontonian scholar. So let's see, just a second. Minnie Max says, now Neufeld and Minnie Max and Urey, they're all amateur sociologists. They love this kind of pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Grand Funk Railroad, says Dave, gets about as much respect as the Dave Clark Five, and they have snazzy hits. All right there, Kyle. Minimax Disco also introduces to the pinnacle of pop, the automated machine drummer. Dave says Country Joe and the Fish were Andy Warhol, yes, in 66, 67. Kyle, when he mentions the Grand Funk Disco, now we're talking, says Dave. Gene says, find the cost of freedom. Gene, here's your answer to the LSD Vietnam experiment. And then Yuri says, believe it myself, Sonic Adventure by Karen Brake. So he starts advocating a song. That's where music becomes a private concern, and people, it's a religion, and people start citing their favorite artists. The chorus speaks the American drug propaganda. Minimax says, Neil Young writes about how quickly they were able to react to Kent State, writing, recording, and releasing a song about it on the radio within 2 weeks, I think. They really got affected by the student protesters being killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's not anti-war. That's anti-police, which Neil Young would have known about in L.A. because he was there for the Sunset Riots in 66. So it's the domestic hatred of the cops thing that that Neil Young had responded. They're anti-police. They're anti-social decency or law and order. Then Yuri says they thought being super high would make them win the war. Minimax, hi, exactly what Dr. D just said. A combat enhancer, so to speak, says Yuri. Dave, disco as much introduces the drum machine as the IC's affordability made tempo-locked beats more and more the norm. I don't know what the IC is, the IC's affordability. Minimax, as if that was the first rapid response topical pop song ever. Well, Kyle, you're up against the experts here, Kyle. I mean, Dave Neufeld, can I take you seriously? You're not allowed to even be on the panel because you mentioned Grand Funk Railroad. Now, Dave Clark Five, they had a couple of good hits, but yes, they didn't have any staying power. So let's remember, we're not talking about music. These are environmental gestalts that are fighting each other, disguised as music. But I got to take a break. Have we finished the?
I think we're good. We did. We had a good run there. I was just going into gay mashups and whatnot, but we'll pick up where we left off.
Yeah. So what we just did is we ran through the chemical body counterculture versus the establishment multi-bodied beginnings, which are replayed by the Android meme in Web 2.0 with everybody's chip body. So the chip body, the Android meme, replay the themes that we're talking about of Neil Young versus the police and the folk world and the rock and roll world before that. That's what my chart says, goes from 1960 to 1990, and then you have the replay of that. We're almost 30 years after the chart, Carol.
Oh.
25 years. So, Carolyn, I'm addressing Carolyn Gorton. That was what we're making relevant. We're showing what Carolyn Gorton's themes are, chemical body, slight astral body idealisms within the chip body mechanism. And that's why the kids go to the Led Zeppelin and Bob Dylan. That's what they go to now. The biggest moneymakers is legacy rock. You know, all the ancient bands from the 60s, 70s are big tour, moneymaker touring situation and keep Dave, you know, away from the moneymaking world. Dave's been hijacked by legacy rock, which is a larger trend for bigger demographics and bigger media dynamics that the little entrepreneur can't really
survive
or counter, unless you start a movement, Dave. And of course, that movement is us, right, Dave? The Ionic movement is the only real, I don't want to say counterculture, what are we? X-ray culture. We are the illusion of success. No. We are yet. So we're the illusion of defeat. We represent the illusion of defeat.
So thank you, Bob, for another great session. Appreciate it.
We hope that Carolyn Gorton is hearing these. I've been sending each performance to her, but no response.